I'm going to ask us this morning to focus our attention on a book of the Bible that is actually very rarely preached from, and for some good reasons. In fact, I would imagine that some of you may have never even read this book of the Bible, or if you have read it, it's been quite some time since you have. But I'm referring to the book, The Song of Solomon. And I want to begin by reading chapter 2, just the first 9 verses. If you open your Bible basically about halfway, just choose the halfway point, you'll be right about there. You got Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and the Song of Solomon. So I'm going to read the first 9 verses of Song of Solomon 2, but I'm most intent to call your attention to an expression in verse 7 that's used 2 other times nearly exactly, so 3 times in the book. The Song of Solomon 2, verses 1 through 9. I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys. As the lily among brambles, so is my love among the young women. As an apple tree among the trees of the forest, so is my beloved among the young men. With great delight I sat in his shadow, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. He brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. Sustain me with raisins, refresh me with apples, for I am sick with love. His left hand is under my head, and his right hand embraces me. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the does of the field, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. The voice of my beloved, behold, he comes, leaping over the mountains, bounding over the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Behold, there he stands behind our wall, gazing through the windows, looking through the lattice. As I said, my focus is on the 7th verse. And I want to repeat this in your hearing. He says, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the does of the field. Strange language indeed for us. And we're not accustomed to being admonished on the basis of animals. But this is what he does. And then he says, here's the real admonition, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. And then that is repeated basically verbatim in 3:5 and chapter 8, verse 4. Now, folks, it is a known fact that among all the literature in the Bible running from Genesis to Revelation, encompassing history and very technical epistles and apocalyptic literature, that the Song of Solomon is unique in that it is an inspired, pure, divinely given commentary on romantic relationships between men and women the way that God actually intended it to be. And at the heart of this passage, I want you to get it right from the beginning, and really it's the main piece of advice being given, is to not let such romantic feelings of love, particularly as they find expression in the premarital state, to accelerate at too quick a pace. It's actually saying, let the pace at which your love really comes to its pinnacle slow it down. That's really what the passage is saying. So I'm going to give my title right now. I want to preach on wisely applying the brakes on premarital relationships. Basically what he's saying is, do not let the fire of passionate love find its full expression prematurely. Keep it at bay. Most of us are familiar that automotive technology has really gone, you know, off the charts. And they have, you know, autopilot basically now, which I will never use. I am much safer of a driver than any autopilot will ever be. My wife would argue that fact completely. But they also have ABS, automatic brake systems. And if you understand how these things work, they detect ahead of time when you're going to be in a dangerous situation. And you know what they do? They just slam on the brakes, lock them up. No, that isn't what they do. Those automatic brake systems just kind of pulsate and they tap, tap, tap. And they, you know, when you're headed toward a crash, they help you prevent it slowly. And this is what really I think the passage is saying, which I will defend later. It's not in natural relationships where you're trying to find that special person for the whole life that you just put on the brakes. Now, your father will probably try to do that. Your mom will balance it out, but your dad's probably going to try to do that. Or maybe it's your mom that'll do it, and your dad will have to balance it out. But it's saying just kind of ABS. Slow it down at a recognizable, understandable, safe speed. Now, let me just say this to you. This is a passage that we need to deal with, I say delicately and with due reverence, but it's a passage we can have some fun with. And it's a passage we can have some fun with because it comments on an area of life that is so very important. Really, those relationships that lead to the union of a man and woman in a permanent, indissoluble relationship. Well over a decade ago, probably about 15 years ago, I was asked to address a group of upper high school students about dating relationships and what at that time was very popular, courtship. And a matter of fact, I think there might be two girls in my church that were actually there. I don't remember if they were there or not. But I took this expression in Song of Solomon 2:7 because it strongly suggests not to let this love thing, powerful as it is, magnetic as it is, it's a beautiful thing to watch the chemistry between a young man and a young woman before marriage. It's good to see it afterwards, but it's pretty neat to see it at the beginning. It's just powerful. It's palpable. God made it that way. And I chose this passage because it tells us to not let this love thing get moving too fast and ahead of a pace that is healthy. Now, let's just all admit something right now. Every one of us in this room know that biblical guidelines and principles for managing romantic love are good and they are needful. I mean, we put up defenses and walls to help us as much as we can with this process. But we also know that love has a kind of a mind of its own. And I think God made it that way. Love is has an emotional aspect as we do, and it's not always subject to reason, right? We know that, okay? I say it this way, love is silly putty. And it won't always conform to the exact shape that we think ought to take. And in the name of a pop song, or in the words of a pop song, love is like a fire that burns us when it's hot. It really is that way. The fact is that it gets away from us. It breaks out. It won't be restrained and held neatly within a wooden box. And so the needed biblical wisdom is this, as translated in the International Standard Version, swear to me that you won't awaken or arouse love before its proper time. That's why I'm calling it wisely applying the brakes in the premarital state before an absolute lifelong indissoluble commitment is made to one another. I am pretty sure in this audience that most of us have seen the movie Jurassic Park, the original version. You know, that one time where the Tyrannosaurus Rex eats the man off of the toilet. You know what I'm talking about there? He just devours him. Maybe you're not as carnal as me. When my kids were growing up, I would rewind that and play it over and over again just for full effect. But in a scene where John Hammond, the bioengineer developer of that park, is talking with scientists that have been flown in to approve the park. He is in a lab, and the scientists are asking them questions. about hatching dinosaurs in a lab, and they begin by saying things like, how do you control this? And the scientist says this. This is verbatim. They can't breed in the wild. Population control is one of our security precautions. There is no unauthorized breeding in Jurassic Park. Well, how do you know they can't breed? All the animals at Jurassic Park are female. We engineer them that way. But again, how do you know that they can't breed? Does somebody go around the park and lift up the skirt of the dinosaur and see whether it's male or female? And he says, no, it's really quite easy. That all these animals, these vertebrates are female. And at a certain stage of development, they need a male chromosome. And we just deny them that so that they're all females. And the guy says, well, this kind of control you're attempting is not possible. He says, it is one of the things that the history of evolution has taught us is that life will not be contained. You remember him saying, life breaks free. It expands to new territories and crashes through barriers, painfully maybe, even dangerously. But, well, there it is. And then he says, you're implying that a group comprised of entirely female animals will breed? He said, no, I am simply saying that life finds a way. Now, I would say this. If the history of dealing with life issues, all dreadfully affected by sin, teaches us anything, it teaches us that love, romance, interaction between people, infatuation breaks free. It gets wild. It won't be contained. It expands to new territories and sometimes crashes dangerously, painfully through barriers. So what Song of Solomon gives to us is a piece of Old Testament proverbial wisdom dressed up in the beauty of poetry to give us a key guiding principle stated in that seventh verse. Do not awaken or arouse in love before its proper time. Prematurely, or until it's ready, okay? Now, I'm going to develop how this passage teaches that, and we'll look at the formula. But first, I want to give a brief overview of the kind of book in which this admonition to not prematurely awaken romantic love is given. A Song of Solomon. I just don't answer out loud. I wonder how many of you have read the book or recently. You know that it is a story of Solomon in love with the Shulamite. And back and forth in the book, the man speaks and the woman speaks. And then there are daughters of Jerusalem that chime in. And some of the Bibles actually have it so that the sections are broken up when the man is speaking and when the woman is speaking. And my wife and I, in a couple occasions on our marriage, have read through Song of Solomon together. And I read the male part, and she reads the part that's the feminine. And I really love that part where it talks about my abdomen is like carved marble. And I, well, she goes, unconvinced, Todd. Totally unconvinced, you know. But I can still dream, right? Okay. Well, somebody has said of this book of the Bible that it is perhaps the most difficult and mysterious book in the entire Bible, the first place among the puzzles of literature. It is very difficult, and most of us need help with it. But there are basically, when you come to interpreting the Song of Solomon, there are three views to how to approach it, and I'll tell you which one is clearly the right one. The first interpretive approach is to view it allegorically. And by an allegory, that means that the details of the story are meant to convey hidden spiritual meanings. It's not literal, okay? And the story does not present real events related to actual people and actual persons, but communicates spiritual truth in an abstract way conceived by the mind and imagination of the author. I'll give you an example of this. You remember the part where he says, you are black, but beautiful? Okay, well, in the allegorical approach, that doesn't literally refer to the Shulamite being black and very attractive. One author who takes this allegorical approach says that being dark means the church is ugly with sin before conversion, but her being described as lovely refers to her spiritual beauty after conversion. Now, that's a very dangerous way to approach the Bible, because the interpretational limits are as broad as the person's imagination, and we have rules that guide us. The second approach to the Song of Solomon is what we would call the typical view. You got the allegorical and the typical. And the typical view is where Solomon in the story typifies or represents Christ and all his love and care for his bride, the church. And the Shulamite woman, the woman, typifies or represents the church in all its response to Christ. It's different from allegory because the characters are viewed as real historical persons. There was a real Solomon, there was a real Shulamite, okay? But their romantic lives are drawn out as a picture of a spiritual truth. I think, though I hold to that, this one has some bearing. And many of our best commentators and preachers of the past held to this typical view. But the third view is what you would call literal. And it just says that there is a set of songs, that's why it's called the Song of Solomon, that sketch out the development of romantic love from the initial stages of desire to complete fulfillment. That's, if you read through Song of Solomon carefully, that's what you got. You start with this budding romance, it goes through these stages, and then wow, it hits the climax and they're united in love. What 2:7 is saying, just make sure that happens the right way and at the right pace. One commentator said it this way: Song of Solomon is patently a collection of Hebrew love poems celebrating the experiences of a lover and his beloved as they taste the beauty, power, agony, and joys of intimate human love. And I may say to you, I'm coming up on 40 years of marriage, ups and downs, difficulties, but the camaraderie that you grow to experience with the person that you're one with is exquisite. And frankly, it's the difficulties that make the high time so wonderful. You know, one of the great things about marriage is this, that you get to see your mate for exactly who they are and all their wonderful strengths and all their ugly blemishes. And that's okay. Now, frankly, I don't want any of you other people seeing my blemish. Mike, it's all right for Kathy to see it. I don't want other people to see it. That's the wonder of marriage. What, since that's a dynamic, do not arouse or awaken it prematurely. What it does then, okay, is develop this romantic love relationship through the stages one of courtship in chapters 1 through part of 3, in which yearning desire intensifies and is met with a response. It even unfolds insecurity and the fear of losing the beloved person. You know how in premarital relationships there can be insecurity? You're unsure? Well, Song of Solomon actually unfolds that. I don't have time to point that out specifically. And then it goes to the wedding, where the author unfolds the bridal procession and the experience of the wedding night in all its glory. And then finally, it goes through the processes of difficulties in marriage relationships leading to maturity in the relationship. Problem like the wife's indifference and the husband's absence. And problems like a desire for greater and more continued emotional intimacy and romanticism. Okay, so that's just Song of Solomon in a nutshell. But now we come to the explanation of verse 7. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the does of the field, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases, until the proper time. Now, I don't think this will be too technical for anybody in the progression of arguments and explaining the text that I'm going to make, but I do have to go through some interpretational questions, and I think you'll follow them pretty easily. But the first matter of interpretation has to do with the meaning of the second part of the verse, where he says, don't stir up or awaken love until it pleases. And here is the question: is the thing being adjured legally called upon not to stir up or awaken love prematurely, is the thing being adjured to a person, either the man or the woman, a he or a she, or is it just adjuring or talking about love itself? Now, one view holds that the words not to stir up or awaken are either coming from the man adjuring the woman to not arouse love prematurely, or coming from the woman adjuring the man not to arouse love prematurely. Again, I said, Song of Solomon is this dialogue between the man and the woman, and sometimes these daughters of Jerusalem. And sometimes the woman is just close in connection before marriage to this person she loves, and all of these feelings are being felt. And he's saying, okay, they're great, but watch the pace. Be wise in all of this. And so sometimes it's the man speaking and sometimes it's the woman speaking. And there are different views about who is speaking in 2:7. Don't stir or wake. Is it Solomon or the Shulamite? I'll give you an example. How many of you are carrying the New American Standard Bible, which is the standard translation we use at our church? Did you notice the pronoun? Do not arouse or awaken my love until, what's it say? She pleases. Which means who is speaking in this, the man or the woman? The man is speaking. It's taken to be Solomon. Don't stir it up until she wants it. She's ready. Okay, but the King James Version, because it's interpretive, uses the male pronoun. Stir not up nor awake my love till he pleases. And the difference between those is because sometimes different translators interpreted the man to be talking, where some interpreted the woman to be talking. But really, the word there translated he or she is a neuter, and that's why the version I translate says it. Don't stir it up. That is love. So the other possibility, which I think is right, is that the thing the author is addressing is the potential problem with arousing love itself. Don't stir up or awaken love until it pleases. Does that make sense? So we're not so much talking to the person. Don't get too inflamed. Love itself has a proper time. Now, the other matter of interpretation under this second expression in the verse centers on what is actually meant by not stirring up love or awakening it. Do not, blow the embers of passionate love too quickly. Okay, that's what the verse seems to be saying, okay? But one of the interpretations of this takes exactly the opposite meaning that I believe is so. And one view says that it's actually calling upon the person to not hinder the full feelings and display of love. Don't hinder it at all. Let me tell you how they arrive at that. The feelings of love here are compared to being in a sweet dream state. In other words, don't awaken love. So it's understood that the person's kind of in a dream state. You ever been in a dream state where everything is... Dreams are pretty cool. They're not always cool. I never have nightmares. I cannot remember the last time I had a nightmare. My nightmare pretty much begins at 5:30 in the morning when I wake up. But I haven't had a nightmare in a long time, okay? But I recently, because of my hip replacement, had to go on hydrocodone. And I found out real quickly why they don't just hand that stuff out. You can get addicted real quick. And that stuff put me into what I called a sweet zone. In fact, I was praying with greater clarity than I had ever prayed when I was on that hydrocodone. I may have been due to some other things. But basically, what I'm saying is, in a sleep state, you know, things are just really neat. They're cool, if I can just put it that way. In other words, what he's saying is don't interrupt that dream state by waking the person up, because it would be like breaking the ecstasy of love being experienced in that dream state. In other words, love is being felt in all its intensity through a dream. Don't awaken it. Don't arouse it. Again, I don't hold to this, okay? A variation on that interpretation is that the bride is talking and she wants to actually awaken the dreaming lover, Solomon, whose slumber impedes the full display of love. She wants him to be aroused from this sluggish display of love and overcome the inhibitions of love. Like a person awakened from the slumber of sleep, she desires the full active alertness of love. That I just see is completely untenable because it's saying don't awaken. But one view holds that what she's really after is come out of the slumber and let all your love be felt. No, don't awaken it prematurely. Now, that's just the second line. Or the first interpretation under that. The second view, which I think has the most merit, interprets it to say this. Do not prematurely arouse love. Premarital love. That's the basis of my sermon. Wisely applying the brakes to premarital relationships, okay? Now, don't awaken or arouse love before its proper time. Now, it interprets the idea that love should not be awakened from the dream state because when awakened, love comes to all its intensity, sharp awareness, and full power. You know what it is to initially wake up. Some may wake up faster than the others, but some people don't wake up for hours. I mean, really wake up and they're sluggish and that. And this is the idea. Okay, is if you wake it up to all its full powers too quickly, why, then there are some problems that can come with that. Love needs to stay in the drowsy state until the right time. If you fully awaken it before the time it is ready, it may bring about the same kind of clumsy recklessness that can be experienced when too quickly leaping out of the bed and trying to walk a straight line in complete control of your balance. Do not prematurely do this. Do not prematurely stir love and do not awaken out of its more dormant state. Now, folks, that's colorful Hebrew poetical language full of illustrative metaphorical concepts, but there's a literal meaning being conveyed by that, and it is this. Arousing love, premarital state, must wait under the guidance of sovereign providence in both parties, or until both parties are mutually convinced that the strong sentiment of love is proven to be God's will. And then they can fully share in all of its wonders, but not until then. So until such a time, keep all the powers of love slow and lethargic like the mind and body when in sleep. Now, practically, folks, here's the reality. When a young man and a young woman come to the age where they can properly begin interacting with thoughts of marriage, and typically that doesn't happen around 13 or 14 years old, when they're ready, but their passions and desires for this will start really going off the charts. What this is saying is that wise parents, wise believers recognize something needs to be in place to keep it at a pace from getting going too quick or there can be disaster. I don't even need to spend much time with this. How many lives have been ruined because in immaturity, couples proceeded breakneck speed, lightning speed, without any guidance from Scripture, and they ended up, since marriage is the second most important decision affecting your long-term happiness, ruining their life. Matter of fact, I'll take just a moment to share a story. I, of course, did a lot of premarital counseling. And one of the things that I did, I had a piece of paper just like this size of my notes, and it was a premarital questionnaire that the man and the woman who were thinking about marriage, who came to me for counsel, would fill out ahead of time. And it basically had five questions. And the five questions had to do with the five leading causes of divorce. What is your view about children? What is your view about the role of the man? What is your view about the role of the woman? What are your views about religion? Are they unified? And what they had to do was check anyone where they thought there was a disagreement between the two. So every now and then, neither one of the couples would check anything. Great. Sometimes one time I had a couple, the man and the woman, both checked the same box. So I said, well, that's not a deal breaker. They both realize, you know, there's an area of concern. I once had a couple, young couple, 18 years old, fresh out of high school, had developed a relationship with thinking about marriage. They filled this out. All five of them were marked. And they were, and one of them marked three and the other one marked the other two. So I told them up front, I said, just be aware going into your marriage, you have some things that may not be deal breakers, but you are in fundamental disagreement on essential matters. And that couple, I don't do premarital relationship in order to break up relationships. I want you to know that. But they realized they didn't have the unity necessary for marriage. And so it was a success, and it was a success because they did not get married. And in my mind, they didn't arouse love prematurely. It may have been aroused, but at least it was able to be stayed. Now, so that's the literal meaning. The second matter of interpretation, past, don't stir up or awaken love, has to do with what does it mean by, I adjure you by the daughters of Jerusalem and by the does and by the gazelles, okay? I can only deal with this real quickly. The daughters of Jerusalem in this love song are the female companions of the Shulamite woman who is in love with Solomon, and they, kind of as her comrades, are being admonished not to encourage this love prematurely. Daughters of Jerusalem, this is good for you too, do not arouse or awaken love until its desires. But the adjuring by the gazelles and does is another matter. What does that mean? I wonder how many of you would be prepared to say, what is the meaning behind I adjure you by gazelles and does or female deer not to stir up or awaken love? Well, let me give you an example. If I said this, we're so unfamiliar with this, but if I said to you, I adjure you by the Corvette and the Lamborghini to get to church on time. Why, you'd know I am probably referring to the characteristics of those motor vehicles that are fast. You know, those are supercharged cars. You know, on the basis of how a Corvette could get you to church right on time. Why, be here on time. There's no sub-message here, by the way. It's just an illustration. Church attendance is another sermon. So you would get it. But what about, I adjure you by gazelles and does? Well, he is referring characteristically to the wild, swift, and free tendencies of these animals that act on instinct to suggest a more controlled and deliberate decision about the time when love is allowed to blossom into full bloom. In other words, folks, the gazelle, most of you can picture one of these things in your mind. It looks like a deer. It's got these two long horns, typically a black stripe. Okay, these are in the antelope family. Have you ever seen these things leap? They are fun to watch, especially when a lion or tiger or leopard is after them. I mean, you can really see these things can run, they say, at full sprint at 60 miles an hour, and they can maintain a constant pace of 30 miles per hour, okay? The warning then is this. Like animals that display raw, natural powers of passion and strength that know no reserve, do not shamelessly and with abandonment excite the formidable powers of love until it is clear that God Himself has brought it to this point. That is what's said. Now, having made the case that romantic love should not be aroused prematurely but wait until God's perfect timing, what does this actually look like for the modern Christian? And at this time, I have a handout that I want to give to everybody in here. Can our men come forward with these two? The rest of the minutes that we have together is just going to be application using this thing as a guide to help us. This is especially helpful for seventh graders through college age or young professionals and their parents who all, if they are conscientious about the importance of marriage, want some practical guidelines for how we do this. So I'm going to wait till everybody gets this. And once all the people in the congregation have it, I will go over it. This is something that I developed 15 years ago and went through it with my church family on a number of occasions. And I'm reworking it a little bit here for us this morning. But any questions about what I'm saying Song of Solomon 2:7 says? Don't stir up love. Stir up love. It's great. And when it reaches its pinnacle in the will of God, wonderful. But be careful about doing it prematurely. Well, since not everybody has it, let me get a little feedback here. We're going to have a little talk back time. What's one of the tendencies when, let's say, I don't know, a 18-year-old high school senior and a 17-year-old junior start really dating and they start getting close? What's one of the tendencies that can indicate some immaturity? And I'm not thinking of anything physical. Think with me. Scott.
Dropping all other things.
You got it. Total preoccupation with nothing but that person. It's understandable, but it can be a warning sign, and it's not the indicating of people progressing maturely. And by the way, folks, I didn't have that. I was one of those people right there, preoccupied, nothing else mattered. I wish somebody could have told me this before, and even when I was a younger parent trying to train my own daughters. I put this together, I think, of necessity. So I want you to just look at the chart first. We'll go through specifics, but it's a biblical guideline chart for guiding and gauging premarital relationships. And then if you look at the five areas along the top before that verse, what is the essential quality or biblical virtue needed? And then it talks about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 categories. And then the second line over is the biblical passage where the teaching or principle is found. In other words, if I'm saying this is an essential part of measuring the biblicalness of a premarital relationship, can I support that biblically? The third area is indications that the quality is missing or seriously underdeveloped. The fourth category is possible ramifications if not addressed. And then I couples who I take through this, I say check for problem areas. Check for problem areas and we can talk about them, okay? Now, I do need to give a few disclaimers before I go through this, okay? Number one, this thing, you guys especially, you boys who have not got married, or maybe you're not even in a close relationship, maybe some of you are, but you're concerned biblically to do this the right way, I want to tell you something first. This is not meant to be used mechanically. This is not a master, it's your servant. So I would not suggest to you, let's say you're going on a first date, a close friend has lined you up with this girl, and you take this chart, and while you're talking to her, you're going, not so. Guys in our generation have a capacity for idiocy that is beyond my ability. Dating and courtship is not that hard. Be normal! That's what I'm saying. Just talk and figure things out. And by the way, I will digress here. You know, some years ago, a book was written called I Kissed Dating Goodbye. It was a book on courtship. It had some real merit to it. And all the rave was you never engage in any premarital kind of relationship. You never interact with the opposite sex unless it's with the intention of marriage. I recognize the problem with modern dating. But I believe when we strictly go by courtship, we actually force all relationships to be considered marriageable, and we end up violating the very point this passage is making. Don't do that. I'm being very just practical and honest and I'm no expert at it. I thank God my three daughters married godly Christian men who lead and provide for them. Okay? But when they were in college and really began dating, I said, date as many guys as you can. My theory was the more the merrier. And my theory was interact with them and get to know. And over time, God will let the person surface who will really be your mate. And folks, you know, That, like I said, love won't be kept in a wooden box. Doesn't always work that way. In other words, I have two daughters that had very close relationships, thought they were going to marry, didn't happen. God led them to the man they were going to be married. I have one daughter. She met the man she ended up married to, happily a good man, in high school. And that's, you know. And so what I'm saying is this, there's not this binding rule, but these are general principles that can really help you. The second part of this disclaimer is not, for those of you who are married, but may have not have had this knowledge ahead of time, not all married couples get the privilege of knowing this ahead of time, and that does not make your marriage second class. Just like many other areas where we were in ignorance before salvation, we let the new knowledge we gain as Christians only improve our lives, right? Not all of us started off on the ideal foundation. Some of us got married unsaved and then God saved us later. Well, we just let God renew us. And thirdly, this applies to all of us. Some of you are thinking, well, this whole sermon has to do with people in premarital. No, it has to do with them. It has to do with the younger. It has to do with parents who walk their children through, especially when those children are godly and want their parents and welcome their parents' involvement. And it involves grandparents, right? Because we all have a part in this. So let me just go through a few things here and then we will close out. I can't go through the whole chart. But so first of all, do you see the verse up there? It says, "So then, do not be foolish, but understanding what the will of the Lord is." One of the questions I ask on that premarital relationship thing is this. What is the most essential question or factor determining whether you should get married? And sometimes people will say, well, does she really love me? Well, that's pretty important. Or is he a good leader? That's important. What is the number one question that has to be answered before you marry a person? Is it the will of the Lord? Is this God's desire? Well, that begs a question. How, pray tell, do we determine that? Well, that's cool. Remember that section in Ephesians? It's a subtext, and it says, you know, you hit a little button, and it opens up, and it says, on June 26th of 2020, we'll just take Russell for example here. Russell is to marry so-and-so in my will. That's simple. There is no such statement in the Bible. So what do you have to do? You have to draw all the scriptures that comment upon this together to guide you, right? One of the truths is, you don't marry an unbeliever. We went over that in Sunday school. So look down. So the first essential quality for a Christian is salvation, need for indication of a genuine experience of regeneration. In other words, folks, I have countless scriptures here. Do not be unequally bound with an unbeliever. What companionship is there between the believer and the unbeliever? The non-Christian, the infidel, and the believer. Okay, all these passages. 1 Corinthians 7 says, be married, but only in the Lord. Deuteronomy 7:3, consider how Solomon's wives turned his heart away from God. So we're saying, here's what we're saying. Going back to my original illustration, your daughter comes home. She's a good kid, loves the Lord, and she has met this moral, upstanding man with a good education, good family life, well on his way to professional success, and he's an unbeliever. Wisely apply the brakes, or in this case, which one? You cannot let that go forward. You cannot assume, well, God might change the person's heart. I can tell you in pastoral counsel, I've met my share of people grieved because they allowed to form a marital relationship with an unbeliever, and it is the most lamentable thing they ever did. You make sure that the person not only claims Christ, but gives genuine evidence of this. Okay, and you can look at the indications, okay? I have one down there. The person never goes to church. They don't think it's important to go to church. It's never been high on their... Folks, people that are saved put a importance, a premium on church attendance. Let's go down to... Let's just do one under life surrendered to God. Here I say, a need for a strong relationship to the Lord, an indication of an ongoing work of sanctification. In other words, folks, by the way, we're not talking about perfection here. I said last week, somebody in the bathroom was talking about perfection, and I said, you heard about the guy who was looking for the perfect girl. Well, he found her. The problem is she was looking for the perfect guy. When you finally get married, you are marrying sinful imperfection. But these things at least go ahead of time so that certain things are in place. I had a friend, just to digress, I had a friend who was probably about 30-some years old, and he was really eager to get married, couldn't find anybody that was compatible. And I quoted to him one day, I said, Tony, I said, who can find a virtuous woman? He said, Todd, who can find a woman, period? He was struggling. So life surrendered to God. What about, look at devotional life. Do you think a marriage partner who is going to fulfill your desires and walk with the Lord for you needs to be a Bible reader? Folks, I realize that that is creating a fairly high standard, but I think it's very important. Go down to parental involvement. Let's go to the second one. Of course, your parents need to consent, but what about acceptance of advice? You know, one of the tendencies for young people who don't have the experience and wisdom that their parents do is to not listen to their mom and dad. You will secure the happiness of your future by the willingness to accept the godly counsel of your parents. Are they perfect? Can they make mistakes? Could they misguide you? Yes. But you can't be misguided by following the Lord's admonition to honor them. You can't. You can't go wrong. God's sovereign over all of this. And I look here for indications that the quality is missing, parental involvement, a rebellious attitude, proud know-it-all, hides important facts from the parents. What about truthfulness? To God, to one another, to parents, to everyone. Folks, I have a chart that something that I used years ago. It's called Warning Signs. And it's given to couples in marriage when, you wouldn't believe the number of girls and guys who have walked down their wedding aisle and they have nothing but reserve. They are reserved about doing it on the day of their wedding. And what this book does is says, okay, if you are experiencing these red light signs, slow it down. It may not mean cut it off. In other words, does every date end in an argument? Every single date ends in an argument, but when we get married, it's going to get a lot better. Can I tell you what marriage does? It compounds the challenge. Doesn't make it easier. Right, married people? Okay. So I'm being real down to earth here. Physical contact. I just simply say this. When they're dating and young, no physical contact. As they get a little older, limited physical contact. Upon engagement, appropriate physical contact. You work that out. You're pretty smart. You can work that out for yourself. And the pace of the relationship, this is really what we're talking about. Don't stir it up or awaken love until its proper time. Now, there's no absolute scriptural rule, but there's a general principle that a rush to judgment may not allow needed time to observe the person's character. You want to know the person ahead of time. Now, folks, that's the chart. You'll have to work through some of it yourself. It is a guide. I want to conclude this way. Matthew Henry, the famous commentary, once talked about what he called the idyllic conditions of the formation of the marriage between Adam and Eve. They were without sin. God joined them together in perfection. And he says this. He said, marriage is honorable, but this surely was the most honorable marriage that ever was. For God himself all along had an immediate hand in it. Those are likely to settle to their comfort, their happiness, who by faith, prayer, and a humble dependence on providence put themselves under a divine guide, scriptural guide. The wife that is of God's making by the special grace and of God's bringing by special providence is likely to prove a help fitting for a man. Let me just say this. For some, God was not at all involved in their planning of their marriage, let alone central to it in all the important choice of a mate. They had no idea, being lost or immensely immature, to know how to apply Bible truths and assure their own happiness by faith, prayer, and a humble dependence upon God. And folks, as a result of that, sometimes the character of one partner or both is formed in ways completely unaffected by Christian principles. And that can make the marriage much more difficult. You could even have two Christians, but one who does not have an appetite for spirituality, does not have a heart to go forward. God isn't central to everything. It's not a divorceable situation, but can really affect the unhappiness of the person who wants to go forward. Folks, there are Christians who are saved, but who are not being transformed by the regular reading of God's Word. And that's what you want. So what's the answer? Whether you have the best foundation in premarital or not the best, in whatever original state you began your marriage, let God transform your character. This is needed regardless of your starting point. So, do not prematurely stir up or awaken love until it's God's will. And you have had some practical ways to determine if it is God's will. Heavenly Father, we pray and ask you to bless what I regard to be this rather unusual message, but I hope may provide some practical help for people who are just serious about the will of God in their marriage and their relationship. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.